The last two lectures, we have been discussing the layout of typical compilers together, and we have been concentrating on the details of the very first phase in compiling, which was the scanner phase, where we saw the main purpose in generating a sequence of classified tokens out of a rather unspecific input, meaning it's just a generic string. We have in detail talked about the concept that we don't want to do the whole thing manually, but instead use a generator for the whole thing. And then we were talking about the details on how such a generator can be implemented. And for that, we have seen ways for specifying token classes and ways for implementing certain entities for finding these token classes in generic input. In detail, we've been talking about regular expressions and finite automata as the implementation for a particular regular expression, and we have been talking about how to get a non-deterministic finite automaton from such a regular expression, and then we've been talking about the practical implementation issues on these non-deterministic automata. So now we can go on and assume that we can create automata from regular expressions. Now we have to assemble the whole system into a scanner. And that's what we're going to do in this chapter about scanner design. So now we've got you had a lot of theory in the last slides. So in a practical system, how would you design such a scanner? So in practical systems, you will find a lot of configuration details, of course, which I'm going to strip from here because they are highly dependent on the actual implementation of the scanner generator. But the part that you'll find in almost every scanner generator is the one that links the particular specifications of the regular expressions. These are the E with the index in this part of such a scanner, together with a user-defined code part, which is over here, designated with these actions. And the idea is that each of these action blocks is executed each time when the input matches the regular expression to the left of this action. That way you can get access to the point in time when the scanner decides that this is an instance of a token class, and you can take the action that you deem appropriate for that thing. In most of the cases, when you plug this scanner within a whole stack of compiler components, then you will just redirect the detected token and its class to the next layer, which will then try to find out something about the hierarchical structure and the role that this specific token is taking in this hierarchy. But you might as well do a lot of other things. There's, for example, these applications for scanners in other fields of compiler construction. Each time that you use something like syntax highlighting, you'll probably have used a scanner without even knowing Well, most of the syntax coloring is simply done based on syntactic properties, and these are ones that you can determine with our systems here. So you might as well just give certain color information together with the actual token content to the output, and you are probably already done with what you want to do here. So that's what you will make of this structure. So that is a kind of structure that you would like to have. However, what does it really mean if we write something like this? Well, there's certain properties that come into play if you apply this whole thing as a scanner. For example, you're interested in actually having clear semantics on how these particular regular expressions are actually working together, because you might have kind of overlaps in the things that are specified with these regular expressions. So the things that the kind of common starting ground on which all these scanners are actually according, we have a thing that for all the specified regular expressions, we are interested in the maximal prefix from the input that matches either of the specified regular expressions. So you want to have a kind of a greedy scanner which matches a certain amount of input. That kind of decides on which of these regular expressions actually matches with the input, although there might be some kind of overlaps between the fractions of the matching content. But still, if there are still if it's still not unique, then the only way to cope with that is some kind of convention, and the convention here is that we take the minimal I such that the detected word is actually matching with the particular regular expression, which means that if you take the longest match and still have multiple hits in your regular expressions, then you just take the one that is nearer to the begin of the file. So if a regular expression E1 and EK are both matching, then we'll take E1 because it has the smaller index. And then if we have matched the whole thing, we will actually execute the action that corresponds to this minimal I. Okay, so much about what the convention says. How can we implement that? And the whole automaton will be the deterministic finite automaton for the whole expression E, which is actually just the alternating between all the regular expressions that we specify for the whole thing. And we will have we will treat the final states that correspond to the whole regular expressions automaton differently, depending on how they match with the finite states of the particular sub-regular expressions from E1 to EK. And this will help us in implementing this priority that we have talked about, meaning that the ones which we specified in the beginning of the file actually are of higher priority than the ones that we specify later on. And we will do that by just taking the final states from the whole automaton and take the ones from there which are also finite states for the sub-expression E1, and we will have them in a particular set F1, which is the final states for just the the regular expression E1, or its corresponding automaton, of course. Then we will continue with all the remaining final states, meaning that we have to subtract the states that are associated with regular expression 1 now, and take from that the states that belong to regular expression 2 and take them as the set of final states 2, and so on until we reach our final regular expression, which was this one, and we build up the corresponding set of final states for that in a similar way. Okay, so you see, when you have done such a construction with these helper attributes, we can reuse them already here in these parts of our complete scanner implementation. Okay, and now if we find that our scanner run on this maximum input actually ends up in one of these sets of final states, then it will only match with only one of these final sets, and from this we can take the index and just execute the appropriate action. So that's how we implement the whole thing. Yeah, now the only thing that still remains to be solved is the maximum match, so the greedy part of the whole thing. How can we achieve that? Well, we will track two kind of pointers, A and B, which will track states of our parser, and we will kind of use the A as a kind of backup for my actual pointer B, which will be running through the input, and as soon as my input pointer state pointer B is in a finite state, we will back up exactly this state into pointer A and continue to run through the whole system with pointer B until pointer B hits some condition where there's no valid transition with this input symbol to any final state anymore, and in this case we will just take A's position as the one to go. So let's see how this works in practice. So assume we have already consumed a little bit of input and are now in a state where we continue our parsing. Then we will start our scanner with our actual pointer B in the start state, pointing to the front of the still to parse fraction of input. Our backup pointer is at the moment not initialized with any valid final state, but still nevertheless points to the beginning. So we will move on, and there will be a lot of transitions going on, and we will move our pointer forward as long as we still go through the path of our automaton, and at some place we will find ourselves in the situation like this, where we will have passed all the input symbols from this right line word until here. Here we will have a final state of our scanner. In this case, well, we didn't see the actual scanner, but let's assume that 4 is, in this case, the number of the final state for the identifier. And as this we just say that it is a final state in this case, so we copy it over to our backup pointer, and the backup pointer points to the same cell as the other one. So now we are in the crucial step in a language that has these identifiers that do not contain any blank spaces like this one. The next step will have to be one that will end our match at the moment, and this is actually what happens. So there's no match anymore that our actual pointer will point to, so it will go to no state at all. In this case, we will have to say, okay, so now we have definitely gone through all through the sensible number of matches that is indeed possible for this input. So let's have a look back at the longest match, which must have been the one that we have backed up into our pointer and state A. So we will read 4 as our token class or end state and consume the input until we reach the position pointed to by A. So this will be consumed, and we will restart our algorithm with the initial values for our components like this, and we will give the consumed content as our token together with a classification to the next part. Well, yeah. So we will then call the action that is specified for this regular expression that corresponds to the identifier, which will then give the whole thing to the next phase in the compiler. So that is the idea of how to implement this longest match. Mm-hmm. There's another thing that you might encounter in practical implementations. There's also the concept of states. So the idea for that is that you introduce certain special cases in which scanners behave differently to other special cases or the general case. And for these special cases, we introduce so-called states. And the idea here is that as we have actions in our scanner implementations, we can decide at some point, probably triggered by some special input combination, that we want to leave our general state of scanning and enter a special case or a special state. And yeah, in this case, we want to scan differently to the way that we did before. So that can be implemented with these scanner states. An example where this might come in handy is, for example, when we want to implement comments. And yeah, as you know, for a comment, it is absolutely a comment is indifferent to the symbols that you use within, as long as you don't use the ending combination for such a comment, or which might be the only actual input that you will react to. So that's an application for comments. Can you imagine of another token that might benefit from states? Strings inside the quotes? Yeah, that's the idea. So similar to comments in strings, you might use operators or other combinations of input symbols that might be valid keywords or something that appears completely in a different area of your source code. So during the scanning of such strings, you might also decide that you want to be in a different state than the general purpose scanning. So, yeah, that's another famous use case for states. So, if we apply states in our scanners, then our inputs might look a little bit different to before. For example, what we are going to see there is that we will have then state specifiers that come before brace pair. And in there, we will have all the regular expressions that are valid within this scanning state. And we might have several of these blocks. In order to navigate between these states, we must introduce some way of doing that. And the idea for that is having special purpose instructions within our actions. And for historical reasons, they always use the thing that you see here, which is a which is looking like a call statement, and it always calls the special purpose method or procedure YY begin. This has been the convention since the times from early YAC parsings and Bison parsings. So, the actual LEX and the FLEX implementations and the Java implementations, JLEX and JFLEX also have the same convention in order not to confuse the programs that are used to the old standards. Okay, so in case that an action contains such a YY begin state, as soon as the action terminates, the scanner will continue not in the original state from the beginning, but then in the state that is specified with this identifier. So, for example, for the comment, it will start in the initial state. That's, by the way, once again, this YY thing, which indicates this is a convention that came from ancient LEX times. So that is the marker for the general purpose state, which is the initial states, state in which the scanner begins. And here we have just one regular expression. Of course, in practice, there will be more, but for this example, we only have one. And in this, we will match with the combination that begins a comment, and within this the action, we will just have the statement that switches to the comment state. In the comment state, we will match the combination that escapes from the comment and goes back to the initial state, and in this case, we will actually perform this state switch with initial, and in any other case, we will just do nothing, as for our purposes, our parser will just not do anything in when hitting a comment. Yeah, so that's how typical usage of these states actually looks like. Okay. Good. So far, there's a lot of specific syntax you need to know in order to use these scanner generators. For example, there's the dot, which is a special symbol, a special character in these scanner generators that matches all characters, but not the line feed character, which is determined with the backslash n. And there's of course a lot of other input characters, but you have to look into the documentation to do that. Yeah. In terms of implementation, you might already have an idea of how to achieve this behavior. The idea is to keep separate automata for the different states, and switch to the other automaton in case the user has issued this call to Weiber Begin. Okay, yeah, so that's I think most of what we have in what we have here for theory for scanners. Yeah, so that is what is actually used in the first phase of a compiler. Is there still any questions about the lexical phase in compilers? Okay, so let's start a new topic, syntactic analysis. What is syntactic analysis about? Well, the idea is to emanate from a sequence of classified tokens, and the output should be the structure of your input according to the ideas of your language. So this seems like something that requires a lot of hand-coded routine jobs. So once again, we have the vision of why should we do the coding ourselves? Well, there is, of course, a lot of handwritten parser components out there in the wild. For example, the GCC C and C++ compilers are actually ones that are handwritten, and yeah, they do quite well with that. However, this is something that might be a little bit tedious and it requires a lot of effort to do. And considering that this a kind of a trend in informatics to come up with so-called DSLs, which is domain-specific languages for solving certain problems, it might not be feasible to come up with handwritten parsers for all the DSLs that you might come up with, especially as a lot of them evolve and have a lot of change in their syntactical ideas. And yeah, this might be something that's actually too much for these small special purpose projects. So once again, the idea would be to not do the whole job by hand, but once again, we would like to generate the component that does the parsing for us. So what are we lacking of now? We lack of a specification of how hierarchies in our language looks like, and we lack of an implementation, therefore. So is there any ideas of how we could do these specifications and implementations? So there's still things. Well, for the last phase, we have already applied a few of the principles from theoretical computer science, which were regular expressions, which we found quite appropriate for specifying token classes that then could be easily implemented with regular automata. So the idea in this case would be to go to the next concept in terms of expression power, which would be then a little bit more relaxed ways of specifying grammars, which is context-free grammars. And for context-free grammars, well, to have any idea of implementing context-free grammar-related things? Well, in order to read input and check whether they conform to such a context-free grammar, we might use pushdown automata, for example. So our idea would be to use context-free grammars to specify relations between token classes in terms of hierarchical structure, and use the generator to create pushdown automata that actually run on these sequences of tokens. And according to token classes, then group the input into units that belong together from a hierarchical point of view, and give the whole thing back as a tree. So, let's dive right into that. For that, we should probably first of all agree on a common starting ground. At first with our specification means, which is the context-free grammars. So the context-free grammars are, that's something that I've already told you a few moments ago. These context-free grammars we use as rules that that correlate the things that we get from the scanner, which is classified tokens. Of course, there's a lot of different instances of these tokens out there, as we have used in our scanner, or as we can use for our scanners, token classes like identifiers, which can be arbitrarily long, and so we have infinitely many inputs for the whole thing. But the key idea here for this structural definitions is that we don't specify the rules on the actual tokens, but rather on their classes, because we only have finitely many classes for tokens. So, the token classes are the basics for our grammars. We use them as the terminals of our grammars. And with these terminals, we can come up with rules. And for that, we also need non-terminals for the left-hand sides of our rules, which are the kind of the names for the groups that we built from these terminals. So we will also have non-terminals and terminals, which are the token classes. And so we will use this context-free grammars for the structures of our programs. What are context-free grammars? Well, you might have heard of context-free grammars already in theoretical computer science. I don't know whether you have heard of two of the key persons in that area. Well, probably people have already heard about the Backus-Naur form, which refers to that John Backus, or some kind of, the other famous name that is around there is from Noam Chomsky. Where do you know Chomsky from? Or Chomsky, or that nobody knows how to pronounce that. The whole hierarchy in theoretical computer science between the different automata model and languages and the different grammar hierarchies is actually, that's the Chomsky hierarchy. Okay. Also, you might know Noam Chomsky he actually does a lot for human rights. So if you are into that, you might have heard famous speeches from him. So that's a field where he's most active in recent years. Anyway, context-free grammars, what are they all about? For context-free grammars, we need four components. So there's the set of terminals. That's something we have talked about a lot right now on the last slide, which was just for the purposes of our the use case, we will have as terminals the token classes. Then there's non-terminals. We need them in order to give names to our hierarchical structures. Then we will have a set of productions or rules, and these productions are the actual rules of our language. They are actually determining how the sub-hierarchies in our general hierarchy are actually looking like. And then we also have one special symbol, which is the start symbol. Also, for context-free grammars, we will have a special form of productions. Not all productions are actually good for context-free grammars, but there are very special ones, and they look like this. For context-free grammars, we have rules that have a left-hand... Well, rules are, you can always find such an arrow operator in such a rule, and that separates the left-hand side of the rule from the right-hand side of the rule. On the left-hand side of the rule, in the case of context-free rules, you have a single non-terminal. There's never a terminal on the left-hand side because, well, they are intended not to be expanded anymore. They are the terminals for the whole thing. And there is the right-hand side for context-free rules. And the right-hand side, which I abbreviated with alpha here, is a sequence of arbitrarily many symbols, either from the non-terminals or the terminals. And the sequence, together with the left-hand side of the rule, actually determines one subpart of the whole hierarchy. Okay. How does it look like in an example? That is one of the famous examples that you've seen in theoretical computer science. Surely, that's the one that actually reduces the whole thing to counting opening symbols and verifying that the closing symbols are just as many as the opening ones. So for that, we need two rules, two productions. The first one actually correlating an opening and a closing symbol. That's the A and the B. It actually also tells us that between A and B, we might continue with other rules. And these other rules are either the same rule once again, or in the other case, we might terminate with our whole thing, the whole term rewriting system. That's how they are called. And in this case, we will just rewrite our left-hand side with the empty string. And yeah, with these means, we are able to specify a very special language. That is the one that has as many opening symbols as closing symbols, and we can have arbitrary many opening symbols as long as it's a constant number. Okay. Yeah. In the example, you have already seen that I've used a few conventions in there. For example, you'll see me using green always when I take non-terminals in a rule, and I will use blue for terminals, like here. So that is kind of something implicit in order to not have to specify what the terminals and the non-terminals are in my grammars or in my rules. when I see, have them afterwards. Also, I might, if I go away from my abstract rules and terminals, non-terminals, I might go over to more concrete ones, where I will just spell out the name of the token class as the terminal. I will also do so in blue. And if I have practical examples for non-terminals, I will spell out the name of the production that they are associated with, which have in most cases some kind of concrete meaning. And in order to differentiate them from the other ones, I will use these special brackets. Also the color. So for a practical example, what can we do with these grammars? Well, this can be considered as some kind of, that's a fraction of a practical programming language, like, let's say, something that's similar to C. And in these cases, we will have grammars that look somewhat like the one that we see here. So we have one starting symbol, S, which is defining the whole program. And such a program is, in our case, can be considered as being a statement. Now you might ask, what is a statement? A statement is then considered to be either an if, or a while, or a... What is REXP? Yes. Do you happen to have you visited the virtual machines lecture at some point? So that's the connection points. You might realize that if you have attended the virtual machines lecture, that a few of the words that you see here are actually similar to ones that you see in the virtual machines lecture, and that's also the connection point. In virtual machines lecture, we will give for each of these syntactical ideas how to generate code from that. And so these words do actually carry some kind of meaning, and we are actually at a point where we generate these the structures from which in the next part, well, there's a little bit of typing in between, but then we will generate code from that. So that has a purpose here, and this is a right-hand side expression. That's right. Yeah. For what is an if statement? An if statement has, well, the if statement, that's how it is introduced here. It has a terminal, a token, which is a keyword if. It then continues with an operator, which is one of these braces. It will also be closing this bracket at one point. And it will also have an else keyword somewhere. Well, that's how we define it here. This might be something where we will find a different specification somewhere else, which doesn't have an else. That just depends on how you define the language. And you will have you will find that in a kind of recursive way, we will find other statements in the if statement, which might occur between the condition and the else, and also after the else, we will have space for another statement. Also, we will have one of these ominous right-hand side expressions in our condition part. Okay. So, what are other statements? There's, for example, the while statement, which is quite similar to the one that we had before, the if statement. This one is defined also with a keyword. We will have our condition delimiters with these brackets here. And once again, we will have a recursive definition which refers to another statement. And we will also have this condition expression. Yeah, and for the condition expression, we have, or for this right-hand side expression, we will have several different ideas what we might make of this right-hand side expression. So we will have this int here. This might be a little bit of a surprise for you to find int here. Well, you have to keep in mind that this is still on the token class side, not the actual token that you find here. So int here might not directly translate to the input characters int, but mean a class representing an integer. So this is the terminal that was generated when we found the integer. For the other int, we might introduce something like a type token. So yeah, that's to be expected differently, to differ from each other. Then we also might find some kind of comparison in order to implement our conditions. You might also have some other thing that might be might remind you of something, which is this L-exp, which is just a left-hand side expression, and left-hand side expressions are something that we see defined over here, which is just a name or identifier or something like that. And of course, both of the expressions are not done yet. You might still find a lot more possibilities that those are. So, yeah, they have to be continued. And for proper languages that were defined with a proper syntax in mind, you will find resources where you can look up the grammar for these languages. And those are, yeah. In theory, they should be something that you should be able to put directly into these parser generators. However, there's a lot of grammars out there that are, for historical reasons or for any other reason, not really in a form that you can directly put into these parser generators, either because they are not really context independent or have any some other ugly features like plain text right-hand sides where language designers describe what should be matched with the right-hand side of this rule, which is really a pain in the backside to generate a parser from, but here you go, that's practical grammars. Yeah, in any way, what we are concentrating on are the proper, properly defined grammars like this. For example, the Java grammar was designed in the lab somewhere, and it had, at least for a few years, it had a nice context-free grammar, which you can also get online. Also, large fractions of the C grammar are context-free. Well, large fractions. Yeah. But anyway, for these, the parsers work quite fine. And if you're lucky, you'll find some ways around the non-context-free parts of these specifications and can use such a parser generator anyway. Yeah, so in order to cope with these grammars, of course we can write them in a very confusing way and just distributing all the rules that belong together that are kind of similar over the whole specification file. However, in order to make life easier for me and you, we should probably have a convention that if we have different variants for a single left-hand side, then we should put the variants all together in one of these rules, and instead of reiterating another rule with the same left-hand side, we should just use the alternation operator. This one. And if we have done so, we can then just enumerate all the alternatives that we have on the right-hand side with a single number, and we can identify one alternative for this production by just mentioning its left-hand side non-terminal and the number of the production. That makes makes specifying that we mean one specific variant for the rule a lot more easy if we do so. And you will see us using this kind of notation somewhere else in the part that is relevant for these grammars. And in this case, that's what we mean. We mean the jth rule, which has the A as a non-terminal on the left-hand side. Okay. So these are the conventions that we are going to use. In the course of the following things, we will see that we will also encounter different ways of specifying grammars that will actually match the same language. For example, we have those two grammars here. I think you will have seen the second one already in theoretical computer science. Which of you has never seen the second version so far? Never? So that was not topic of theoretical computer science? Okay, so here you go. That is one of the most famous ones. That is the grammar that is able to generate arithmetical expressions, and especially of course depends on what expressions you want to produce. But in the version that we encounter, it has the addition and the multiplication, as well as the braces in order to introduce priority, and it sports identifiers and numbers in there. So that's expressions on natural numbers, or any number, and names, and they're plugged together with addition and multiplication. But of course, you can also have other grammars. For example, the one above. That is the one that actually makes use of the fact that you don't have to be you don't have to specify your grammars in a way that they need to be rewritten in a certain way. And you can achieve the same language as the one at the bottom with a few other productions or rules, and you can cope with just one non-terminal in this case. Both of them describe the same language. However, they will have certain differences, which we will explore in the next few slides. So for the purposes of those two grammars, we will have the scheme that we have introduced in the last slide. We will enumerate the particular variants of our alternative productions just from left to the right. Those are the numbers that will be used on the next slides, just in case that you want to look in detail at the steps that we do on the next slides at home once again. Okay, so let's talk about the meaning of these rule sets, of these grammars, and the meaning of these grammars is closely related to the so-called derivations. So, what is such a derivation? We see these things, these grammars as term rewriting systems. Term rewriting systems are systems where you do certain rewriting steps according to your rules of your rewriting system. And the way you do them is whenever you encounter in a string a symbol that you have as a left-hand side for one of your rules, you will just replace the symbol with the right-hand side that you find in these rules. That is how the term rewriting system aspect of such a grammar actually works. And a sequence of such rewriting steps is what we call a derivation. Let's have an example with the grammar, I think with the second grammar from the last slide. So just to remind you what is actually on the last slide. This is the one that we're going to use. So E goes to E plus T, or T. T goes to T times F, or F. F goes back to E, if you use the braces around, or it just produces the terminal's name or int. Okay, so let's do the derivation for here. We start with a sentence which has just the symbol E there. So for that we can choose any production or rule that has the E on the left hand side. So let's be simple, just use the first one that comes to mind, which will rewrite the whole system into E plus T. Now we have the choice between several alternatives which we could take for rewriting. Let's take the leftmost one, which is the E, and that's what we mark with the underlining here. And let's this time use the second production, which is the T, which gets us T plus T. Well, that's nice. Now I can continue with just a T, and let's do so for the first one that we find here, and replace with the first alternative, which is T times F. And now for a change, let's not do it on the first position, but on the second position, which is the F. For F, we have... let's not do that infinitely often, but just come to an end at some place. So let's replace the F with the int if we have the opportunity. So now we have reduced the number of options that we have for replacing. We can replace the first T or the second, so let's do the first one. In this case, we go to the F because that keeps our options little. And then, well, let's do it once again and come to an end with a name. Now we have the chance to replace the T, and as I'm now bored, let's go all the way down to terminals. And now that we have terminals, we don't have any rules for terminals anymore. So we have to terminate the whole thing, and we have generated a sequence of terminal characters. So that was one way of having a derivation with the rule set that we have seen before. And the sequence in which we did these steps, these rewriting steps, is actually called the derivation. So what mattered here was the alternative that we have chosen for the specific non-terminal that we replaced. And also what mattered was the way that we arranged them together, meaning when we every time that we had the choice, for example here, or we could choose from T, F, and T in order to reduce, it actually makes difference for this sequence of derivations whether I choose the first one or the second one, because in one way one option I may rewrite the T, and the other one I rewrite the F. So there's a different sequence coming out of the whole of the system. So that is what derivations are about. we can put this in more formal context by actually defining a relation for these derivations and kind of nail what we mean when we say derivation. For that, we say that the derivation relation is a relation on words. These words were things like these or these. So these are different instances of words. And there's a derivation relation here, this one, between two of these words every time that the first word actually has a non-terminal for which we have a production in our set of productions such that we keep the prefix and the suffix of this word, carry them over to the next word, and just replace the non-terminal with this non-terminal with its right-hand side. So in case we have an according rule, then these two sentences are in derivation relation. And the whole derivation is then the repetitive application or of this relation or the chain of sentences that are connected to each other with the derivation relation. That's what we call the reflexive and transitive closure, and we will denote it like this. So with the closure of the derivation relation, we will be able to this spans as the set of all the derivation that belong to a specific rule set. So this derivation relation and its closure is actually something that depends on the rule set that we take as basis for the whole thing. Okay, and what we see is that there's still a lot of choices in there. Especially, we can choose the spot where we will rewrite, and of course, we will be able to specify the alternative, the rule that tells us how we will rewrite. And the actual language that is now specified with grammar is defined with the help of the of derivations. So all the words that are actually rewritten along these derivations are the ones that that belong into the language of the grammar for which we have constructed the derivation relation. That is the basis for these derivations. Okay. Clear? Okay. So, especially what we see or what we observe is that whenever we have some different disjunct fragments of the whole thing, it's not important how the fragments are derived. So let's have a closer look on the derivation tree. The derivation tree is a way of representing a specific derivation. So for the example that we've seen before, I've now annotated the derivation steps with the numbers that were associated with the alternatives that I chose, together with the positions, which are these underlined bits on which I have applied this rewriting rule. So for the derivation tree, we will see that the inner nodes of derivation trees are rule applications. So for each of the inner trees, I have as components of the nodes the the left-hand side with which I have rewritten, as well as the alternative for which I have decided how to rewrite. The root for the whole tree is rule application for a certain non-terminal. In our case, we started with E, so it this must be a rule application with E on the left-hand side. And the leaves of the whole tree are, as we see here, only terminals. Yeah, what are successors of nodes? Successors of these of a certain node for the non-terminal B and rule number I correspond actually to the right-hand side of that particular rule. So rule 0 for the non-terminal T was actually composed of T, then the terminal star, and F. So that's how the whole things are connected. So there is such a derivation tree. Now, we can, of course, do wild rewriting in our sentences, but this is something that creates, of course, choice. And choice is if we don't base our choice on certain criteria, that is kind of a source for non-determinism. So in order to come to a more deterministic model, we now focus on specific derivations for which we agree on a certain criterion how we will rewrite our sentences. And for these we will use actually the position, so that gets us rid of one of the sources for non-determinism. So we will concentrate on derivations that rewrite just the leftmost non-terminal that we find within a sentence, or for other special derivations we might just consider the rightmost derivations that are possible. These are the two obvious simple principles to that we can apply as special constraints on how to do rewriting. So that's special derivations, leftmost derivations or rightmost derivations, which we are going to talk about. And in order to designate whether we have done the whether we want to perform a certain derivation step in the leftmost or rightmost choice, we will, in case of doubt, we will just denote this by putting a small L or R in the index. So that's how we will differentiate them from each other. Yeah, and if we look at these derivation trees, then if everything works out fine, then the only difference between doing leftmost or rightmost derivations is actually in the way that we do our depth first traversal through this derivation tree. And in case of leftmost derivation, we will have a left to right preorder depth first search traversal through the derivation tree. And if we do rightmost derivations, this will kind of match the right to left preorder depth first traversal. Well, that's kind of logical, because the depth first traversal also has to choose a kind of the agree on the way of choosing which child to visit first. So that's just a one-to-one relation that we have here. And this is actually, and there's also something a little bit strange here, which is the reverse rightmost derivation. This might seem odd at the moment, but this might come in handy later on for us. So let's talk about something that is the reverse of the rightmost derivation. This is something that corresponds to left to right traversal through the derivation tree. But this time we will consider our matches in the first traversal as post order. Yeah, this is probably a little bit too much just from simple words. So let's see how these special derivations correspond to these depth first traversal. So let's start with the first way of traversing the whole thing, which is for the leftmost derivation. You will start with the first one, which is this one. Then we go to E1, which is this one. Oh, no. We go over here. Then we will go to T0, which is here. Then we will go to T. So these are the ones that we already have. Then we go to T1, which is this one. Then we go to F1, which is this one. Then... next, what still remains to be rewritten is the second part of T, which is the F. So we do F2. So this goes over here. Then we will do T1, which is this one. And at last, we'll do F2. So now that you have tracked the way in which I went through the whole tree, you will have seen that I went actually like this, which is just a depth-first traversal. And I always... crossed the derivation steps out when I entered a subtree, which is the post-order traversal. No, the pre-order, sorry. And and I always chose the left branch first when choosing my children to visit, so that was the left to right ordered the first search. So I can also do the same thing for the rightmost derivation. In this case, I start with E0, which is this one, and go to, in this case, T1. So I go over here. Now I have to do F2, which is this one. Then I will have E1, which is this one. Then T0. Continue with F2, which is over here. And we'll have T1, like this, and then F1. So I went this time, I also went depth first, but I went first to the right inside branch, went back up like this. So that is what the rightmost derivation does. It is also a pre-order depth first search, but this time right to left. So what happens if I reverse this sequence of derivation steps, then I come to the reverse rightmost derivation. Yeah, what is that corresponding to? Well, at first I do F1, which goes like this. Then I do T1, which goes like this. Then I do F2, which goes like this. Okay. So then I have T0, which is this one. Then I have E1. Then all of a sudden I go over to F2, which is this one. And I continue with T1. And then I have everything I need for E0. So in this case, what I did was I also went on a depth first search and always took the left branch. But I visited these nodes when I came back up. So that's the post-order traversal. Okay. So these are the special derivations. Now let's talk about the grammars that are actually most useful for us, which are the unique grammars. What is a unique grammar? Well, the unique grammar has a certain property, and for this property we need to focus on the actual leaves of the derivation trees that are possible for this grammar. And we call the these leaves of the derivation tree in the sequence in which we find them within the tree, we call them the yield of the tree. So for this derivation tree, the concatenated leaves of this derivation tree is this name times int plus int, which is in this case the yield. Okay. So unique grammars. For unique grammars, we actually call a grammar unique that if for every combinations of terminals, there's at maximum one derivation tree. One derivation tree T, for which actually yields such a terminal sequence, or none at all. So this actually says that there is no two derivation trees possible for that grammar that actually have the same yield, that have the same sequence of terminals at the bottom. So there's actually only one of these derivation trees that's possible to come out with this rule set, and that's already one of the or a sufficient property to differentiate the grammars that we've seen beforehand from each other, because this one is a grammar for arithmetic expressions. The other is two. But for the second one, we have the interesting property that we can, for each valid arithmetic expression, we can only find one derivation tree that adheres to the rules of this grammar. For the grammar above, we can actually have different derivations that have the same output. So there's ambiguous way of creating derivation trees for the first grammar, and as derivation trees will be kind of the thing that we will be after in the end, that's something that is not desirable for our purposes, so we don't want to work with grammars that have ambiguous ways of creating derivation trees. So we will concentrate on the unique grammars. Okay. Yeah, so that's just repeating the things that we have seen beforehand for work at home. So let's come to, yeah, probably that's just the one thing that we haven't talked about. The leftmost derivations can be kind of seen if we just turn the whole thing around and want to come up with a derivation not starting from the starting symbol but from the actual input, then we can see this leftmost derivation as a kind of something that can not be so easily achieved from a point of view from the input, but for the that thing, these special reverse rightmost derivations are the ones that are more natural to us, because, well, you've seen that for the arrows connecting this derivation trees, I started from the bottom and kind of only completed certain subtrees when I had all the branches already covered. So that is something that is, these reverse rightmost derivations are something which comes in handy if we do bottom-up analysis of the syntax tree. If we do top-down reconstruction, then probably the version that we've seen before with just doing leftmost derivations is the concept to follow for us. So these are the two variants that we have, and they designate different concepts of how to come up with a hierarchy for our input. Anyway, that's all that I want to say about grammars and rules. So let's probably have a quick peek into how pushdown automata work, because they will be the means of implementing compilers for us. So what is a pushdown automaton? You have seen these things in theoretical computer science already. They have a kind of logic part that defines certain rules. Then they have an input part, which is consumed with from the pushdown automaton. And it will have, as a helper structure, it will have an actual pushdown or stack in order to compute. And we've seen that, well, not here, but in your lectures in the past, you've seen that with these pushdown automata, you can verify the correct nesting of braces by just putting opening braces on the pushdown and removing them as soon as you read closing brace. So yeah, that's how you can use this pushdown automata. For example, what does such an automaton look like? Yeah, we will have states. For states, we will use numbers, as we have already for the finite automaton part. So these are possible states. And certain states will be marked as start states, like this one. And we'll have final states, for example, these two. So these are just the basic initial components. And then there's the actual logic that will be used by these pushdown automata in order to consume the input and rewrite their helper structure, their pushdown. So what do these things look like? These are transitions. You can see a bunch of them here in a kind of table. And they are organized in a way that they have, as they are seen as a line in this table. One of these lines is a transition of such a pushdown automaton. It has three components. The leftmost component is a sequence of states, which is considered to be matched with the actual top of the pushdown. Then we will have a second component, the input symbol, which is the next one to consume. And the third component is the new top of the stack, which is generated by going this transition, which means that with this transition, we specify that if the top of the stack is 0 and the input is A, then we will replace the 0, which has been on the stack before, with the 1-1 and continue without the A in the input. In such way, we will have to read the other lines of this table as being other transitions. Yeah, you might have seen slightly different specifications of how pushdown automata are constructed or what their components are. For our purposes, we do not differentiate between pushdown symbols and states. We will just use the same namespace because that's what our algorithms only need. The very rightmost or upper pushdown symbol is actually the considered to be the state of our automaton, and the every transition consumes the upper part of the pushdown. Well, I should probably also add an S over here because, well, as you see, this transition is in some places using several symbols as first component. Okay. So once again, if we introduce one famous concept as the pushdown automaton this time, so let's have a look at famous people for that. For example, we have Friedrich Bauer, who has been a member of this university just until a couple of years ago. I think it's fairly recently that he unluckily died. There's also Klaus Samuelsson. Both of them together, no, why not? Yeah, both of them published a common work on this pushdown automaton. So, what is a pushdown automaton about? Pushdown automaton is about, well, we have already seen that we have to specify the set of states as the first component. We also have to specify the input alphabet T. Then we have to highlight several states or to mark a state as the start state. This is a state that has to be in our set of states, of course. Then we mark several of these states as final states, and we will have a set of transitions. Transitions are kept in this delta relation, and they relate a sequence of stack symbols together with possibly, or at least at most, one input symbol with arbitrarily many states that have to be pushed on the stack, or the pushdown. Yeah, a computation on the pushdown automaton is something that consists in the actual content of the of the pushdown and the remaining input. So it is it consists in a sequence of state symbols as well as a sequence of input symbols. In our example, let's try one run through an example input, just as finishing example. So let's start with a certain string like this one here. AAA, BBB. And a starting state, the one that we specified above, which is 0. So what can we do from this configuration on? Well, we have first symbol A and the stack state 0, so we have to choose the first transition. So we will go over and replace the pushdown with the contents from here and remove the input symbol. So from there on, what can we do now? Well, we still have A in the input. So with a state of 1, we will just put another 1 into the input. So that's what we're going to do. So the input the stack grows by 1 additional 1, and the input is diminished by the first A. So once again, what can we do now? We have to repeat because we still have A in the input. So we will and 1 on the stack. So we will once again grow our stack and remove the input. And now we are in a more interesting spot. Now we have a B in the input. So this time we will have to grasp 2 elements of the pushdown, which is this 11, and replace them by a 2. So let's do that. So we will shrink our pushdown by one element and replace the uppermost one with 2. And now we still have B in the input, so we have to go somewhere there. And in this case, we can't match with 1, 1 in the input. We have to match with 1, 2, which will lead to only another 2 in the on the push down. So it still shrinks. So we only have 1B left in the input. Once again, we will match with this one. And this is the last thing we can do. Now we don't have any input anymore. There's also no rule for the empty string. But luckily, we ended up in a state that we have marked as the final state beforehand, and we're done. So this seems to have been the rule set and the states for something that's able to count opening symbols and match the number with closing symbols. So that's probably automaton for the language that we have before, which has this language a n p n with n. Yes, please.
We made the last rule as 1, 2, 2, 2, just 1B epsilon or something like this. So the person has to think just grab 1 and not 1, 2. Is this?
I think I didn't get the whole concept. So
just cancel the 2 and the last rule. The last.
This one?
Not this rule, the rule. It's not the application. So only in the box, yeah. Cancel the 2.
Well,
when you cancel it there, then it's
different. So you only want to do like this? So with a 2? So the problem if you do so is that you have to match at the top of the stack. And if you put a 2 on there, you're done. You cannot match anything anymore. Or at least not with this way to write the rule. Like this?
Yeah.
You can just remove what is on top of the stack. Okay. Good. I think there's still a little bit left on there, but I assure you it's not so much anymore. So what we have to talk about is computational steps for such a pushdown automaton. So a computation step is just a relation between configurations of this automaton, and they two of these are actually correlated with a computation step when there actually is a transition in our set of transition that talks about the top of stack like this on the left hand side, and from the other configuration, it takes the top of stack from the transition, and in any other way keeps the prefix, which is the bottom of the push down, the same, and in the same way treats the input in a way that if there is an input symbol X, it has to be in the configuration over here as the very first symbol, and it, is then omitted in the following configuration. So that's how a computational step is defined, and with that we can define the language that is considered to be the semantics of the pushdown automaton, which is actually the series of there has to be a series of computation steps between the initial state and the input such that we reach the empty input together with either final state of our automaton. If we can find one computational step that does so, then we will take the input word into our set of words that actually contribute to the semantics of our machine. So kind of similar to the way how we specified the semantics for our find automata, it's computational steps, but just now they involve stacks as well as the input. Okay, and I think, is there still more to go? I think we'll continue with the rest next time. So that's all for me today. We'll meet together next week. Then have a nice week and goodbye.